Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 334 for September 18th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
Glasgow was always seen as the, you know, a rough city, a city that, you know, you probably wouldn't want to visit, but it has, you know, it has really blossomed in the last 20 years and become a fantastic city.
Thanks to the weather that delayed my return from Islay the other day, I got to spend a full day in Glasgow, and I'll second what Matthew McFadden of the Good Spirits Company says about his hometown. There's a lot for whiskey lovers to do in Glasgow, and we'll look at some of the city's highlights this time around, including one of the world's major whiskey auction houses. That's coming up later on, along with the calendar of events, the comments of the week, and the What I'm Tasting This Week department. First, though, let's look at the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. This is Bourbon Festival weekend in Bardstown, Kentucky, and in between all of the tastings, balls, and barrel rolling races, the Bourbon Hall of Fame inducted its class of 2011. Inductees are nominated by the state's distilleries and the Kentucky Bourbon Festival, and voted on by members of the Kentucky Distillers Association. This year, there are just two inductees. David Hobbs of Heaven Hill is retiring at the end of the year after 41 years. He's been responsible for managing Heaven Hill's entire operations in Bardstown since 1998. During that time, Heaven Hill went from bottling 1 million cases a year to more than 10 million. He's also a longtime Bourbon Festival board member and former Distillers Association chairman. Al Young has been working around distilleries since 1967 when he joined Seagram's. He's been at Four Roses since 1990 and helped develop some of the first distillery tours in Kentucky. His most recent accomplishment was last year's book on the history of Four Roses. Congratulations to both David and Al. Now, speaking of bourbons, Heaven Hill unveiled this year's edition of the Parker's Heritage Collection at the Bourbon Festival. This year's bourbon is a true change of pace for Parker Beam. It's a 10-year-old bourbon finished in cognac casks in collaboration with master cognac blender Alain Royer of Renaud Cointreau. I'll have tasting notes for it on an upcoming episode of Whiskey Cast. A couple of business notes now. Look for a new flavored Jim Beam expression to be unveiled this coming week. CEO Matt Shattuck told Bloomberg News the new bourbon will be available starting in the first quarter of next year. Beam's sales force will get its first look at the new flavor this week. Last year, Beam introduced the black cherry-flavored Red Stag. No word yet on what flavor the new bourbon will have, but based on industry trends, I'm speculating it'll be a honey-flavored bourbon. Shattuck also told Bloomberg he expects the soon-to-be standalone Beam to be acquiring new brands and not be a seller. That flies in the face of some analysts who have been predicting that Beam could become a takeover target. Of course, one of the usual suspects when the talk turns to takeovers is Diageo, which is realigning some of its U.S. efforts. Diageo USA is creating the Catalyst unit to focus on what it's calling high-potential brands, and that includes the entire single malt scotch portfolio. That portfolio is getting its annual infusion of special releases now. There are 7 limited edition whiskeys in this year's series, including the annual Brora and Port Ellen releases, both at 32-year-old versions this year. The series also includes a 12-year-old Lagavulin bottled at cask strength, 57.3% ABV, a 21-year-old cask strength Rosebank from 1990, and a 12-year-old unpeated cask strength Kalila. This year's more esoteric expressions, a 25-year-old Knockando, a 40-year-old from the now-closed Glenurie Royal Distillery. The last time Glenurie Royal was part of this series was back in 2007. And for the first time in this series, a single grain from the closed Port Dundas Distillery in Glasgow. It's a 20-year-old whiskey from 3 different casks. All 3 started out for 3 years in refill casks, then went into either American Oak Bodega casks, First Fill X Bourbon, or New Charred European Oak. Only 1,920 bottles of this one will be available worldwide. Those releases are likely to get some interest worldwide, and that's just a small part of the growth in Scotch whiskey exports this year. The Scotch Whiskey Association released export data for the first half of 2011 this past week, and reports global shipments are up 22% over the same period in 2010. The U.S. remains the top export market in value, followed by France, Singapore, Spain, and for the first time, Taiwan. France continues to be the top export market by volume, with exports of nearly 95 million bottles, compared to 60 million for the U.S. Finally, I mentioned last week that Amrut's peated single malts are being back-ordered until next spring because of demand. Got some good news from Amrut's U.S. importer, though. Amrut is now available in another state. Pennsylvania's state stores have listed Amrut. It's now available for special orders. That's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Time's running out to enter for your chance to win a trip to the Glenmorangie Distillery and stay at Glenmorangie House. You can enter at the Glenmorangie USA Facebook page until September 30th. Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. That data on Scotch exports to France comes at just the right time. I'll be heading off to Paris for Whiskey Live Paris this coming weekend. Look for a doubleheader next weekend with two episodes and complete coverage from Paris. We'll also be recording the next episode of WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings at Whiskey Live Paris. I'll be picking the panelists from people attending the festival. If you're going to be there, make sure you stop me and say hello. Thanks to La Maison du Whisky for making next week's special coverage possible. Let's check the inbox now for the comments of the week brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker. Had a lot of great comments on last week's episode from Brooke Laddie, along with the new WhiskeyCast HD episode that's now available on YouTube and through iTunes. Michael Derezhinsky posted this on Facebook. Thanks, Mark, and thanks to Jim and the crew at Brooke Laddie for giving another meaning to the numbers 9/11. Meanwhile, Mark Newton said, great to see behind the scenes at my favorite distillery. And Jason at GoodScotchDrink.com posted this comment. This is a really great piece, Mark. I sat in Jim's office with him and Duncan McGillivray for an hour and a half last month, and the man's enthusiasm for what he does is extraordinary. You captured that enthusiasm perfectly. Thank you, guys. Meanwhile, Jeffrey Steuben is asking for some help. He wants a recommendation for a big, oily, complex sherried whiskey with decent oak notes in the 12 to 15-year-old range and less than $100 a bottle. I'm going to have to think about this one, but if you have a suggestion for him, please add it on our Facebook community page. Finally, John Newfrey used Twitter to ask for some Isla advice. Here's what he had to tweet. I'm headed to Isla in October. Any tips, places to stay or eat, and how to get whiskey shipped home? Well, first off, John, there are not many hotels on Isla, but you'll find a lot of bed and breakfasts. My personal favorite is Tom and Kate Skinner's Burnside Lodge in Port Weems. But while I was on Isla last weekend, I met Donald Fletcher. He owns the Persibus Farm B&B in Port Askeg, which is also the main ferry dock these days. There's also Antiosda in Brooke Laddie, but if you want a more traditional hotel, check the Port Charlotte Hotel or the Bridge End Hotel. The Port Ellen Hotel is also reopened after a complete refurbishment. Unfortunately, the Macri Hotel remains closed, but I've been told it's been sold. Plans for it are still up in the air. Places to eat. You need to try the cafes at Ardbeg and Kilhoman for lunch, and Duffy's in Beaumont is good for dinner. And as for getting your whiskey home, leave room in your suitcase going over, and wrap your bottles up in clothes going home. Just make sure they don't bang together inside the suitcase. That's what causes most breakage. I'll be doing a WhiskeyCast HD segment on my packing tips sometime soon. If you have a question or a suggestion, you can use Twitter, like John did, our Facebook page, or just email me. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com, and the comments of the week are brought to you this time around by Johnny Walker, on the web at johnnywalker.com, where you can become a whiskey insider today. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Once again, I'll be at Whiskey Live Paris this coming weekend. The Indie Spirits Expo is the 28th in Chicago. The Autumn Speyside Whiskey Festival is the 29th through October 3rd in Dufton, Scotland. That's also the first weekend of the Stockholm Beer and Whiskey Festival. White & Mackay's David Robertson will be in Calgary for a tasting of the McKinley's Shackleton Whiskey and some Fettercairns, too, at the Kensington Wine Market on the 30th. And he'll be leading a Dalmore and Jura dinner the next night on the 1st at Buchanan's Chop House in Calgary. Contact Kensington Wine Market for details on that, too. Glenn Morangy's Dr. Bill Lumsden will be leading a tasting at Keene's Steakhouse in New York City October 4th. Malt Advocates Whiskey Fest San Francisco is October 7th. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Congratulations to Dave Cole. He's the winner of two tickets for the Laphroaig Live webcast from Sydney on October 6th. You can get all of the details on Laphroaig Live by visiting the Laphroaig website at laphroaig.com. While you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla. Glasgow has been the heart of Scotland's whiskey industry for decades. Most of the major distillers have warehouses and bottling facilities there, and the port of Glasgow on the River Clyde was critical in making Scotch whiskey available worldwide. While the nearest distilleries are on the outskirts of town at Glengoyne and Auchentoshan, there's plenty in the city for whiskey lovers to do. Let's start off with one of Glasgow's best whiskey bars, the Bon Accord on North Street, where Paul McDonough and the boys are celebrating the Bon Accord's 40th anniversary this year.
40 years. It's been a big year for you guys.
Yeah, it's a big year. 40 years. The pub's been open 10 years I've been here, so it's a big year. It's a lot of celebrations throughout the year, special whiskey nights, trips to distilleries, brewery trips. And just generally, whenever we can fit something in, we're doing that, you know. So that as many people as we possibly can enjoy the fact that the pub's been here for 40 years. Met the boy that opened the pub 40 years ago last Friday and presented him with a bottle of Bon Accord malt whiskey so that he could take it home and enjoy the celebrations of the 40 years. So that was quite nice to meet him and his two daughters in the pub. It's only the second time I'd actually met him. So that was quite nice. Very nice old gentleman.
So with about 250 different whiskies, you finally have your name on one, right?
Yeah, I did the Bon Accord malt for a couple of years now. But that's one of the things you get. It's what the pub's all about. It's the tourists like that type of thing. You know, they like to take something away with them. Mm-hmm. They remind them of the pub as well as Scotland and stuff like that. So that's a good thing, you know. And it's a nice dram. Yeah, it's a nice dram.
You having fun still?
Always having fun. Love the job. Meeting people every single day of the week, people from all over the world. It's absolutely fantastic. I had three girls from Chicago in last week, mother and two daughters. Done a personalised sampling with them, and after doing the personalised sampling, the usual photographs behind the bar, they were sitting at the bar and I was talking them through a few different beers, and a couple from Vegas came in. So the five of them sit at the bar, and a good bit of fun with them, you know. And that's the thing about this trade that I'm in, is every day's a bit different, you know. It's not just the same old thing. So it's good, yeah, I'm enjoying myself.
How'd you wind up buying the bond to begin with?
The association with the place for about 20 years, coming along to it, various nights out, blah, blah, blah. Always liked the way it was with the cask and this and the old side of it. It was never a whiskey pub, but what I did was when I taken on, I decided that was going to grow the whiskey side of the business as well, to make it that bit unique within Scotland, which it is. A lot of places got a lot of whiskey, a lot of places got a lot of ales, but nobody's got what we've got the both of them. And a good range, 1,000 different beers a year, 250 malt whiskies, maybe 350 a year. So it's always changing. Bottles come off, disappear, and there's other bottles going on, so it's always changing, you know. The whiskey menu basically is in date for about a week. That's why I was saying earlier on about getting an iPad and the whiskey menu on an iPad, easier to change it. A lot easier. Instantly, as the bottle's off, it's away, out the menu, a new bottle comes in, instantly in it. So it's a lot easier to keep that up to date, you know.
What are your patrons drinking these days in terms of the malts?
Oh, yeah, I think Ailey's getting... Ailey malts are the ones that most people are going for now. An awful lot of people are going for the likes of the Brew Clary, because it's not got a heavy peat content. You still get the Ardbeg. You get the people who love their Ardbegs and all that, you know. McCallum's a great seller. That's a great, easy whiskey to drink. it's a nice whisky to introduce people to, especially the McCallum Sherry. It's a nice one, and what you're basically doing is more people are trying different. They're not sticking to, I'm a Glenfiddich man, and that's what I drink, and I've always drank that, my father before me. When you come into a bar like this, you're talking to people, try this. The next thing you know, oh, I never realised how good that was, or this or that, because it's getting people to break that habit. You know, it's milk and two sugar. That's what they take. Get them to break that habit. Let them sample, and it's the understanding of it, and understanding how to sample malt whiskey, and that's what makes it.
You mentioned a lot of turnover on your whiskey list. How much turnover will you have in a month?
And that's many bottles will I sell, you mean?
In terms of what listings you'll have and which different types?
It will change. 10, 12 different ones a month. It'll be changing, but throughout the year you're talking about 350 all in. But it'll change. It's constantly changing. I mean, I've got a couple of bottles in my office I haven't even brought up yet. But I'll bring them up in the next few days. There's a few in the cellar and the spirit store that aren't even up in the gantry yet. It's just finding space for them and with all that, you know. So it's constantly changing, you know. I've never actually had taken a record of it, you know, in the respect of that. But it's forever changing. And that's what makes this type of job that I'm, type of business that I'm running, because it is always changing. Well, it makes it very interesting.
What's the rarest malt you've got these days?
The rarest malt? Well, that would depend.
You had Black Bomore for a while.
I've got Black Bomore, yeah. I've got White Bomore. I've got St. Magdalene, which is quite rare as well. I've got quite a few rare ones. We just opened up a bottle of 21-year-old White Mackay Special Reserve, which was absolutely beautiful. That's just finished. I've got one I've just brought in, and it's a lovely one for Duncan Taylor's, and it's a grain whiskey, a 37-year-old grain whiskey, Strathclyde it's called. Fantastic, absolutely fantastic. There's a lot of these independent bottlings that we've actually got that are quite rare, you know, but not rare that throws the price up too much. And these are the things that I'm interested in, is getting the things that it's affordable to people's pockets. They're not having to come in and spend £200 to have something rare. They can, some rare, spending £15 and getting something, you know. That's the kind of thing that I'm trying to get, that type of a market. Something that the distillery workers will walk in and say, I've never seen that before. They're the kind of products that I'm looking for that make the place that bit special.
And you get a bunch of the industry folks in here too. I know you're just basically right around the corner from White and Mackay's offices, and with all the other whiskey companies that are basically headquartered here, you get a bunch of the industry folks in, don't you?
Yeah, we get the boys from White Mackay. I take groups of boys over to White Mackay as well. So we were up seeing Richard Patterson a few weeks ago, and he opened up and gave us a drop of the Dalmore EOS. That's £15,000 a bottle, so they'll be short of that. The boys, Ian Miller from Glenfiddich, was in doing a sampling, and what was the one he let us try? The new 55-year-old to celebrate Janet, the member of the family who was 110 years old. So that's going to be £20,000 a bottle, so I got a sample of that. So we get a lot of the industry brand ambassadors and with a lot, which is good, because when the people are in, they've been socialising, but they never stop. So I'm introducing customers to them, and people are getting a chance to talk to them and more social kind of basis. So that's good in that respect, you know.
Yeah, this is where they come to drink when they want to have fun.
Of course. And the thing is, the range is here. They can try ones that they've never tried from different companies. So that's the thing. That's when I can see that what I'm doing is working, when I've got the people who are in the industry coming to my pub to try them. That's when I know that I've knocked it off, that things are working, and things are working the correct way.
The Bond's not the only place to find a good whiskey selection in Glasgow. Oran Mór is also a good choice, and the Iron Horse on the east side of downtown has a good selection too. In fact, I was at the Iron Horse the other night for an Adelphi tasting with the members of Glasgow's Whiskey Club. I want to thank the entire club for making me feel welcome. If I start naming names, I know I'm going to leave somebody out. So thanks to each and every one of you for making me feel right at home. For years, one of the best whiskey shops in Glasgow was the Oddbins store on Mitchell Street downtown. Three of the guys from the Mitchell Street shop, Mark Connolly, Matthew McFadden, and Shane Goodbuddy, decided to start their own shop when Oddbins shut down earlier this year. The Good Spirits Company on Bath Street is actually right across from the Iron Horse, and Matthew gave me a quick tour of the shop the other night.
Having worked for Oddbins for 7 years and, you know, been really excited and passionate about what Oddbins were doing, you know, the last few years, you know, things weren't quite so great, and, you know, we realised that in Glasgow we'd really needed something a bit more interesting and specialist, and no one was offering that at all in Glasgow. And, you know, myself and Mark and our colleague Shane got together and decided that what we had to offer was a specialist spirit merchant, offer something more than a wine merchant, not just a specialist whiskey shop, but try and be a bit more broad and in a purely spirit focus. So we decided we're going to open a shop that focused primarily on whiskey, about 50% whiskey, plus a good range of rum, bourbon, lots of gin, lots of brandy, vodka, liqueurs, port and sherry. We've got a wee soft spot for port and sherry, so that seems to have been, yeah, it's been a really interesting experience so far.
How has it been going from working for somebody else to running your own shop, the three of you together?
Oh, I just can't describe how great it is not to have to, you know, to be able to wake up in the morning and think, you know, what we're doing is for us, not for someone else who doesn't necessarily understand the local market. At the moment, it's so exciting being able to walk in the door and see our shop. And, you know, the shop, it's got such a lovely atmosphere. You walk in and it feels welcoming. It feels exciting. The range feels just really engaging. You know, being able to choose your own product, being able to look, you know, speak to all the suppliers, pick and choose what we want, what we think customers would like. It's been such a, yeah, fantastic experience. And I think we've managed to do a reasonable job so far.
One of the things I was struck by when I walked in was the openness of the shop. The layout with a bar that's made out of whiskey casks and the customer service counter combined, it really is a wide open, airy shop that's not as crowded as the old Oddbins stores seemed to be.
I think we've had a really good opportunity with the unit we've got. It's a big space, and we've been very, very lucky. Gary McKinley, who did the shop fit for us, who did the shelving and the counter, has done a fantastic job with his whiskey barrel theme. He's managed to make our whole countertop from whiskey barrel staves that he's managed to flatten out. And it's so tactile, and it's got a wonderful feel, and the smell in the shop is fantastic from all the wood. The front of the counter is made from old sherry casks, and it just gives a real, just a great feeling of something special when you walk in. Yeah, we've been really, really pleased with the fit and the feel of the shop.
Another thing I was impressed by was the selection of whiskeys that you've got, because you've been able to acquire some whiskeys that guys who had opened up a shop 3 months earlier normally would not be able to acquire, but because of your experience in the business, you've been able to work with some of the wholesalers to acquire some of these casks, like the Lecheg from Barry Brothers and Rudd.
Yeah, the Lecheg from Barry Brothers and Rudd was a real coup for us. We were very excited when at Whiskey Live in Glasgow last year, Ed from Berry Brothers produced a sample bottle out of his pocket and let us try this Lecheg. And we'd heard about the Lecheg they'd had earlier on that year, a single cask bottling which had gone down an absolute storm. And he let us try it alongside his German distributor. We found it fantastic, very, very young, but powerful, rich, very long, really exciting whiskey, and we just jumped on top of it as soon as we could. And when he offered us the full UK allocation, we just couldn't say no. It was such an exciting opportunity for us when we opened our shop.
And we've been joined by Mark Connolly, one of the other partners in the shop. And one of the things you guys have done that's interesting, that only a couple of other shops that I know of do this, is the living cask that's up against the wall that you add stuff into from time to time, right?
Yeah, unfortunately we can't call it the living cask because our good friend Richard Joynson up at Logfine Whiskies has trademarked that, so it's Cask 23. But yeah, there's a few shops that do that. It's an interesting experiment because essentially we are constantly adding, it's an ongoing vatted malt or blended malt as you would call it now, and every day it changes, you know, it picks up something from the wood, it gets spicier, it gets more intense. Even from batch to batch, daily, it's constantly evolving. It's a really interesting experiment.
What's in it now?
Highland Park 14-year-old, Boonahaven 21-year-old, Aberfeldy 11-year-old, and now we've added some Ardmore 11-year-old, just to give it a little peaty twang for a bit of a change. Yeah, which will hopefully wear off after a couple of batches for those who don't like peat, but it's not that peaty.
It's not that peaty. No. No, the next whiskey going in will be a sherry cask Deanston, which should add a bit more of that lovely Perthshire cerally note. It'll still keep it sweet and rich, but it won't. It should hopefully, the peat that we've put in isn't too much, so it still is very well balanced, and it'll just add to the richness of the end whiskey.
We turn back to Mark for a second. What growing pains have you guys gone through over the last 3 months that you've had to learn something from in terms of running your own business compared to working for Oddbins?
What have we not had to go through? All sorts, from licensing to, you know, doing the works on the building, getting the stock in. We originally had planned to open last October, and it took us till June this year to actually get open. Just so many things. We just had a kind of a brick wall at every turn, but we got there and we're very happy, very pleased, enjoying going to work for ourselves.
And you're getting ready to go online with sales too, right?
Very soon. Yes. Again, it's just a time issue. You know, we just need to get that done and get online, and that's another extension to the business. Yeah, but there's something else in the pipeline as well, possibly, but we can't go into that right now.
Oh, gee, you can't go into it at all?
Nope. Oh, sorry, that was my pint just hit the microphone. No. No, full stop.
But I know you also have a space where you're hoping to do educational stuff, where you're hoping to do seminars, hoping to do tastings, and do something that really hasn't been done well in Glasgow before, right?
Absolutely. I think as a specialist, the real crucial element is not just being a retail space. It's about engaging with customers, engaging with people, and really presenting the product in a different way, giving people the opportunity to see past the brand and the marketing and look at the liquid in the bottle as a product, and actually hopefully learn more about what they like, not what they're told they like. And that's really important for us, because as a specialist you have a range, you have a depth, and giving people the opportunity to try that and to learn about what they like is a really great opportunity.
The thing that strikes me most is that here we are in 2011, and nobody's done this in Glasgow, which is the heart of the Scotch whisky industry, basically, until now. What took so damned long, Mark?
I don't know. I always have this thing that I say that Edinburgh has everything and Glasgow has nothing, which is part of the reason why I set up my whisky festival in November, part of the reason why we did this shop, part of the reason why we're doing all the things we're doing is because all the things were happening in Edinburgh and nothing was happening here. I can't tell you why that was, but we're doing it now. So hopefully, you know, it'll go from strength to strength.
Yeah. I think, you know, if you look at Glasgow historically, you know, Edinburgh has lots of tourists. So that supports a local market. That supports a tourist trade in whisky. Whereas Glasgow, the tourist trade is only starting to grow in Glasgow, and Glasgow was always seen as the, you know, a rough city, a city that you know, you probably wouldn't want to visit, but it has, you know, it has really blossomed in the last 20 years and become a fantastic city. There's so much going on here. It's vibrant, it's exciting, the restaurants are great, the shopping is fantastic, best shopping in Scotland. It's really coming to life, and with the Commonwealth Games coming here in 2014, in fact, some of the Olympics coming here in 2012, it's one of the only cities in the world that, well, it's probably the first city in the world that can say it's got the Commonwealth Games and the Olympics happening within 2 years in the same city. It's really coming to life. In the last 20 years, there's been so much investment, and I think we're seeing that in terms of visitor numbers. We're seeing that in the terms of the shopping and what the opportunities are for people. But also, I think with the global economy, the way it's gone, we've seen quite a lot of big names and a lot of big retailers starting to drop out and disappear out of the scene. And that gives us an opportunity. You know, the small, the niche, the people that can really offer something different, an opportunity to really fill that gap and do something special.
So when do you open the second store, Mark?
Don't know. Second store, we'll open the tasting room first, and depending on this other thing that we're not telling you about, we'll see what happens. Yeah, I don't know. A second store would be good, but we need to get this one going first. The whole ethos was that we spent our time in Oddbins, and we were constantly asked for not even obscure spirits. Spirits that you should expect to get somewhere in Glasgow. You can get them in Edinburgh, you can get them in London, you couldn't get them in Glasgow. And that was the whole point of opening the shop. So we'll get that first, and then we'll see where it goes.
Right now I'm in a room in Glasgow that almost any serious whiskey lover might possibly be willing to give up a limb to be in. It's the John Corr Room at McTeers Auctioneers. And I'm with Stephen McGinty, the director of whiskey auctions for McTeers. I wanted to talk to you briefly about how the whiskey auction process works, because we report on your auction results routinely on WhiskeyCast, and we hear about bottles that go up at auction all the time. But I don't think people really understand how the whole process works. Let's sort of go through it. If someone has a rare bottle of whiskey, or what they think is a rare bottle of whiskey at home, how would they go about putting it up at McTeers for auction?
We have some relatively simple steps which we go through. A person may contact me by telephone, through a switchboard, via my mobile, or most usually via our website, or send me an email. And I'll get the "Dear Stephen, I have a bottle of" email, and I shall reply to it. We base all our valuations on research. It's not a whim when we attach an estimate to something. We base it on the accumulated knowledge of auction values and auction sales which have happened, not merely with us, but in auction houses throughout the world. This helps us to make sure that we don't value anything artificially highly and then it therefore inhibit bidding. If a person's happy with my estimate, they either bring the bottle to us or have it couriered to us. The bottle, once it's with us, is in our care. I will write the notes which you've all seen on the internet, obviously trying to keep them brief and to the point. And for those of you who are still wondering, UCF just stands for unfiltered. Get the odd inquiry about that. From that point, we go online. We present things in our twice refurbished John Corr gallery. And viewing takes place for 4 or 5 days before the sale. And then the hammer starts to go down in the auction.
And let's talk about the hammer price, because I know that bidders often have to deal with the reserve price that the buyer, or the seller rather, will set, the minimum they're willing to accept, correct?
That's true. We recommend reserve prices for items which we value at £1,000 or more. We ask for a little flexibility for items which come under this. Not that we indulge in sort of Dutch auction practices and take a thing down and down and down until we find a buyer. It's just to have an element of discretion to trigger bidding if perhaps people are watching to see what the mood of the house is. We'll ask for a little discretion to trigger bids, but that, as often as not, helps us to get the maximum hammer price for the vendor, which is obviously what I'm aiming to do.
Who pays for the process? Is it the seller? Is it the bidder? Is it a combination of both? How do you guys make money off of this? Who winds up paying for this?
We charge a commission. A commission for the totality of what a person sells is 15%, plus a small administration fee, which covers the lotting process and the professional standard photography, which goes into the catalogue and on the online catalogue. And the buyer also pays a premium at the end. Both these premiums are subject to value-added tax, over which we obviously have no control, but that is, in effect, how this works.
And the final price that I wind up quoting when I'm reporting on your auctions is the price that includes the buyer's premium. So they're paying a small percentage over and above what their actual high bid is, correct?
The hammer price you see online is merely the hammer price. The small percentage of the commission and the VAT is charged after that to the buyer for discretionary purposes.
How much will that be? A small percentage, 5 to 10%, or is it negotiable? How does it work?
Buyer's fees, as well as vendor's fees, are on occasion negotiable. All things are negotiable, but on occasion. The buyer's fee, all these things are laid out on the website. The buyer's fee is the 20% on the end, plus the VAT raised on the commission, not on that whole sum of the hammer price.
And let's go through it for the seller's, for the buyer's side now. If I'm going to come to your auction, say the one on September 28th, and bid, what do I need to know before I come to your auction or start trying to bid online? Because I know you do take online bids as well, right?
I think the most important thing to know is your own sensible limits as to how far you might wish to go in purchasing that special bottle. Ring fence your funds and research the bottles you want to buy. Don't come into the gallery and then be bewildered like a magpie. See all of it. Experience all of it. Yes, please do. And you're welcome to come and browse away online. But if you're going to buy and you're on a budget, which you're trying to convert into something that's an asset, which will appreciate for you, buy wisely. Do your research beforehand about which bottles you think are going to be for you for aesthetic reasons for your collection or for investment reasons. Phone me by all means and ask me what my opinion is of whether or not one Macallan Royal wedding anniversary is going to be worth more than another. Phone me and ask about things which perhaps appear to be something which will accrue value pretty quickly, but which we don't know might not. Phone me to ask about the things which are definitely going to be blue chip. Things from some of the classic distilleries, preferably from maybe a Macallan of great age with a limited number of release, with a number on the bottle. You know, tick those boxes if you are buying for investment. If you're buying for pleasure, we offer you that opportunity too. If you're buying things to taste them for the first and maybe only time, we can do that too. But at any level in there, for whatever reason you're buying, do a bit of research first. And I'm happy to answer questions on that via any of the media. And then know your spending limits.
That was something I was about to ask, because we're not just talking about high-end, rare, 1,000-pound bottles and up. We're talking about, in many cases, accessible bottles that aren't that rare, but that might not be, say, in someone's market or might not be available to the average whiskey buyer, but they can come here and find them. And in many cases, they can find them for prices that are quite comparable to what they would have paid at retail in some cases, correct?
It's always possible to get what we would consider to be a bargain. We have, for instance, just now quite a little trend of gentlemen of a certain age buying little collections of blended whiskies, which they perhaps haven't seen or had the chance to drink for years. The common interest there now, the keenest interest, is in Crawford's Five Star, an old blend which has not been available for some time, but which amongst gentlemen in Scotland of a certain age is like catnip. So whenever someone brings me a box and says, oh, I've just got six blends, can we sell them? I say, yes, because look, you've got that, you've got an older dimple, you've got things which are bought for people to drink for enjoyment. We have bottles which are for collectors who are beginning a collection or starting to build. For instance, let's say the Connoisseur's Choice bottlings, which may not be fetching the individual auction prices which other independent bottlings are, but which are nonetheless perhaps a potential little nest egg, maybe become more fashionable in years to come. You can buy mid-price collectible items like the Flora and Fauna series, which are of course steadily accruing in value. You then can take a jump up again to the rare malts, which are gaining a great interest among people who are trying to complete sets of them now. So some bottles like our 1972 Brora rare malt fetched rather a nice price for a gentleman last time, about £1,200 for one bottle.
Should one be surprised by the prices you see at these auctions? Is it a case of just being on the right day at the right time at the right place in terms of what a bottle will bring? It might bring £1,000 one auction during the year, and a very similar or duplicate bottle might bring $1,500 at a different auction. Is it just a case of who's bidding, what the market is, and what the provenance of a bottle is?
Competition on the day is a key factor, especially if two people end up whittling away the other bidders and go head to head. If that's a bottle they need for business, or if it's a bottle they need simply because they want the pleasure of owning that rare bottle, or if, as I say, it's to complete a set, which one gentleman was absolutely determined to do earlier in the year because he needed a particular Brora to have the full set of rare malts, he simply wasn't going to be beaten. It's part of my job, a very important part of my job, to present things in the right way, to group things in the right way, so that those lots appeal to the maximum number of bidders at whichever level or for whichever reason they're bidding. So whilst it's an important part, a major part of my job, to make sure that each lot is as attractive as possible, that the one thing I can't control is some headstrong competition on the day. It's what we always hope for.
The
human factor, the interest. Seeing people in the hall together bidding for things is a great thrill. It's tremendous fun.
Tell me about one of the more recent auctions. What was one of the more exciting battles that you saw for something like that Brora?
Let me think. Well, we had some great fun earlier in the year with our Island Odyssey sale, where we had several rare malt Kalila. Now, it was quite fun to see, for the first time in my experience in the auction hall, that we had fair few younger folk in who were greatly knowledgeable and very interested, and as well as the older collectors. And it was tremendous fun to see most of the bidding on those Kalilas concentrated in the room, and for it to get more and more intense as each bottle dropped, as the hammer fell and went to someone, and those who had bid for the first and the second and the third and been unsuccessful looked more and more dogged to beat people. It was like one of those good old-fashioned Hollywood movie poker games in the end. There was a blink factor in the room for that, which was great, and it wonderfully aided the atmosphere.
Do you ever get surprised by the interest in a particular bottle that you might have thought before the auction would not be of great interest, and then all of a sudden on auction day it turns out to be something very special?
I'll admit there have been a couple of occasions where we've hedged our bets slightly and thought, this is an item which we'll estimate sensibly, but which could just might go a lot further. And it's better for me to do that, in my opinion, than to stifle bidding with too high an estimate or too high a reserve. But certainly there was a Glenfiddich, which we hoped might double its estimate and go for around £400-500, and ended up going for £4,000. There are just some for which you can't legislate. It was a toss of a coin for me in valuing it, whether it was, from all the details on the label, the bottle which could have been seriously more expensive. Very, very small details sometimes decide that for us. And because I erred on the side of caution, it just created great excitement as the bidding between, I think, three or four people that day simply went on and on and on. And it was just splendid to watch.
How good is whiskey as an investment? You talked earlier about those who are buying for investment purposes and hoping to build some resale value down the road. I know that we see more tracking indexes now for whiskeys, and a growing market for whiskey auctions around the world. Does whiskey really make for a good investment compared to other forms of investing, or is this just something that, as a lot of folks say, if you can't sell it, you just drink it?
It's still an open-ended process, but my opinion, compared with many forms of investment, it has inbuilt safety factors, even compared with buying wine on Primeur. There are overheads, continuing overheads, which occur in the wine-buying world, and you're still a hostage to that predictive process whereby people have sat on committees and given the opinion that in 20 or 30 or 40 years' time, that case of wine will be absolutely stunning and, if unmarketable, at a huge value. There's still a risk factor in there. There's still an inherent risk of a certain percentage of those bottles being corked or oxidised. Whereas what you have with whiskey, if the product has been bottled properly, you have something which in itself in the bottle, as long as it's kept sealed and stored correctly, is not going to alter or deteriorate. You may have that fractional evaporation over decades and decades and decades you see in some very old bottles. But essentially that spirit is going to be unaltered, so your investment's unaltered. If you have bought a case of claret, you bought one of thousands. If you've bought, as I did once, a single barrel Old Pulteney, I know it's one of 104. There's a sporting chance that one of those 104 or more will have been drunk down the years, every so often. Therefore, when you come to sell, if you wait long enough, you can be offering something which is available across the world in only the tiniest of amounts, and it's being appreciated for its worth and its aesthetic and its history by more and more hundreds of thousands of people each year as the markets around the world for drinking whiskey and then for investing whiskey develop. So in my opinion, it will be virtually impossible to lose out on your whiskey if you're patient enough to sell it at the right time. And of course, it can be stored in a fraction of the space that a wine collection may be.
You mentioned that Old Pulteney bottling. What bottlings have you been tempted to step down from the podium, turn the hammer over to someone else so that you could bid on for yourself?
I hasten to add that the podium job is beyond my skill. I hand over to the expert auctioneers at that point. Okay. Because when I was required to listen separately with each ear and look with each eye, and it's sort of beyond me. But when I'm standing there, it's ethically possible for me to bid. There's no secret in that. I have the dream bottle I want to find, but before I say that, I would love to get my hands on a few nice drinking whiskies I haven't seen for a while. Mortlach 16-year-old or Longmorn 15, for purely pleasurable reasons. I might be tempted to invest in a few more single barrels if I know the provenance. That's not necessarily on a drinking preference. That would simply be on an investment level, because I've got a small portfolio of limited editions and single casks which I've put aside for my daughter, which she can sell someday when she's 21 perhaps. But if I ever found a bottle of Clydesdale, effectively my local distillery down in Lanarkshire, I would bid virtually every penny I had for that, because it's such an intriguing story. And the last bottle was distilled in 1919, and the distillery lies on or very close to the distillery grounds where now lies the hospital where my little girl was born, down near Wishaw. It was a very famous distillery in its day, and it produced an awful lot of whiskey and made money, but it fell victim to the post-First World War recession and probably prohibition too.
You mentioned provenance, and obviously that's important. And how do you track the provenance of a whiskey, given that we do have a rash of whiskey fakes that hit the market occasionally? How can you verify that provenance, and do you ever get fooled?
I hope I don't get fooled, let's put it that way. I am able to draw on my experience from many years in retail with whiskey and wine to look at a thing and say, oh, now, does that look right? But to be honest, not many people, I think, have the nerve to try to fake really valuable bottles. There's a there is a whole criminal industry out there, I've been told, which takes a standard bottle of expensive whiskey, opens it, keeps it for themselves, fills it with the next one down, fills that one with the next one down, and fills the lowest one with the locally distilled hooch. It's far easier to make money mass producing fake alcohol than it is to try to fake individual bottles. If I were in any doubt about a bottle, and of course I'd take the council on board of the older, wiser heads of collectors who've been at this longer than I have, then I'll phone a distillery. I'll ask questions. Sometimes there can just be an innocent question of mislabeling. I've not, as yet, in the year I've been in the job, found something which I could substantiate as a fake. But obviously we have checks and balances, and there are alarm bells that would start to tinkle if we saw something which looked obviously incorrect.
For instance, that Clydesdale that you're talking about, obviously the distillery has been gone for nearly 100 years. How would you check the provenance of a bottle of Clydesdale if it came to you?
There is, there was in previous examples of John LeMond and Robin Tuchek's book, a tasting note on the last remaining bottle that had ever been, which had been in a Wishaw family and had been kept as late as the 60s and was only produced at family funerals for people who had other tastes. So I'd be able to draw on the knowledge of someone experienced in the industry who'd actually seen one. That's how I would do that. I would be making a few phone calls and saying, exactly how did it look? You know, if I think with something as old as that, you get a feel that there's a different style of label as you go back through the decades, where you now have the statement of the capacity of the bottle always there in some form of metric, and you have the expression of alcoholic strength in percentage. And you can go back and say, well, here's a bottle that has no statement of volume and the proof on it. So you can gauge that that is maybe perhaps from the 30s. And then you can go further back and say, well, it's got none at all of either. So you can look at the style of a label, first of all, and get a feel for the thing. But if one's in doubt, there are plenty of resources to draw upon.
Including laboratory analysis if necessary too, right?
Well, we had a collector offer us a couple of bottles earlier on this year who was thorough enough to have had them carbon dated by Oxford University. So there are a great many ways, scientific and research, to work out if a bottle would be fake.
I know that one of the more commonly used, or at least commonly discussed, methods for authenticating most whiskies is checking for radioactive material, because we know that anything that was produced after 1945 will have at least some trace elements of radiation because of the atomic explosions. Yeah. But if it was bottled before then, the odds are that it won't. And if you find a whiskey that has those trace elements in it, then, and it's claimed to be from pre-war era, then you probably have a fake on your hands, at least at that point, right?
I would rely on the science for that one. Yes, that sounds good to me.
Let's talk about some of the bottles that are coming up at your next auction on the 28th. You have some I know at least a collection of very rare Hazelwoods, which is the extremely limited edition bottlings from William Grant & Sons. Tell me about those, first of all.
These bottles are in celebration of the very long life and great contribution to the Grants organization of Janet Sheed Roberts, who was the great-granddaughter of the founder of the distillery, William Grant. She is Scotland's oldest living lady, and she is 110 years old. To celebrate her centenary, a Hazelwood was released, and then on the occasion of her 105th birthday, another very small release was brought out. And just recently, very, very recently indeed, the 110th celebration has been brought out. So for us to have these three together as a collection should give significant interest, and we'll be fascinated to see just where the bidding goes. So we're producing very limited numbers, and I think there'll be a clamour, particularly from our overseas clients, to have the chance to buy the collection in one fell swoop. Other items of interest. We shall walk around and be a bit of a magpie, of course. We have some older Macallans. I think I had mentioned our Crawfords. We have a lovely old bottle of Crawfords 3-star, as opposed to the 5. And you can tell that it's really rather old because it has the old-fashioned metal clasp fastening underneath its foil. We have a broad selection of our rare malts, Rosebanks and Northports, Linkwoods, Chininish, always popular with the investors.
I saw a manager's bottling of Dalyuan up there too.
The manager's drams have recently come to the market with us and are absolutely storming in their prices. They are, we can sell them in twos and threes for several hundred pounds per lot, and people are really lapping them up, I'm assuming, to invest. And our feature this month is the Highland Park Distillery. We have a number of lovely bottles from Highland Park, single casks from the Ambassador series. We have some which previously hadn't actually been available in Scotland, but one in particular for the Belgian market only. We have everything from their new make spirit to a 40-year-old expression.
Yeah, you have one of my favorites down there too, the Bicentenary. That is almost impossible to find these days until they found a few more bottles over in Japan, but that looks to be one of the original ones.
We have more than one Bicentenary in this sale, and actually some are complete with the original seals, which is a joy to behold.
What would that go for, you think, at auction? What are you estimating that one to be?
Our starting estimate of that is 100 to 200, but we're quietly confident that we will create a good result for all of the vendors who have put these up for sale. Because, as you say, it's a fairly unique chance to be able to bid for more than one, so we hope if people are unsuccessful at the first attempt that they'll try again.
And there are some others here too, including, I see one of my interesting, one of the whiskies that people buy to collect but not to drink is the Loch Doo 10, and you're laughing as I say this, because every time one of these comes up for auction, people go nuts over this whiskey. Why are so many people collecting it, even though most people who drink it detest it when they drink it?
We'll call it an acquired taste. I have to admit that I missed a trick many years ago. I went to my local, which is an absolutely excellent whiskey bar down at the end of my street. Always been voted the county's best whiskey bar, and is actually part of the whiskey trail of bars now, the St. Andrews Bar. And I said to our jovial host, I'll try one of those Loch Doos, because I knew that this local supermarket had some. And I thought, I don't want to buy a bottle until I've tasted. Tasted it, tinctured it with water, thought, well, I wouldn't drink that every day of the week, but I sort of strangely like it. But I could see why people would really be forcing it down in some instances. It's not Macallan, let's put it that way. Lo and behold, I got up the next day, they'd announced that they were discontinuing the thing. It trebled in price overnight, and by the time I got to the local supermarket, it was gone. I could at that point have acquired one for £23, and now you can make about 200 with them. I think it was the publicity of the suddenness of the cessation of it, combined with the fact that it seemed to be appealing largely to the non-domestic market. So I think there's been a clamour for it ever since, simply because people want to be sure they've got one. There's still a fair amount of it around, but obviously we know it's a finite amount. We have a dark horse here.
I was about to ask about this one. This is a 28-year-old Glenrothes Glenlivet from back when the distillery was owned by Highland Distillers.
Yes, we have a gentleman who has supplied us with more than one of these, so he's obviously been a very smart purchaser in earlier years. Distilled in 1947, of course, and a real piece of history. And these fetch solid sums.
What do you expect this to go for, or at least what's your estimated opening bid for it?
I'm opening up around $500-600 for this. They were hotly contested in the last couple of sales.
What else stands out in your mind as we walk through the room here? You also have a bunch of miniatures on the shelf over there as well. And I know that there are a bunch of folks out there who collect nothing but miniatures. How does that market work?
This is a small band of dedicated people. I believe they call themselves the Small Bottle Club. And they're magnificently knowledgeable and very, very thorough. And when they come to my sales, They handle every bottle and they know the value of everything. We generally sell miniatures in groups. It keeps it sensible. There is the odd one which we have to value individually. We did sell a 50-year-old Mortlach a few sales ago, and that, I believe, fetched around £300. The miniature world is quite interesting. People are vying to complete sets, to have biggest collections, to have the biggest collection of a certain type. So it's always fun to watch people and have we have a crossover. We can obviously see that people almost certainly buy lots and have selected out of a lot the 50% they want and the 50% that they'll trade or sell amongst themselves. So it's a little mini section of the sale, which is always good fun. We did actually have a gentleman who supplied the bulk of the miniatures in this sale who said, "I've got some miniatures my grandfather collected over the years. May I bring them?" I said, "Yes, come in. How many?" "It's only 800. Which turned out to be about 1,200, actually. So, needless to say, we are breaking them down carefully because it's a lifetime's work of collection, and we're making sure that we do them justice. There are fine, fine old collections of things in this.
And most people today are not aware that many whiskies were bottled as miniatures. Nowadays, you just see the airline-sized bottles of the bigger whiskies generally available, but back in the day, there were some very obscure whiskies that were largely bottled as miniatures, correct?
Not only that, but other spirits too. There are odd bourbons, Canadian whiskies, some mid-Soviet era vodkas, which this gentleman's collection is throwing up, which have raised considerable interest. Yes, certainly there was a great deal bottled. The problem with the older miniature is the evaporation. Because of the physics of the size of the bottle versus the closure, and a lot of them being simply the screw cap fastening, some bottles can virtually disappear. But we try to be very selective, or we show if we have a 40% evaporation rate, we make sure that the buyer sees this before purchasing. But certainly there was a vast amount of whiskey bottled in miniature, of which we're seeing a fair representation now.
You mentioned bourbons and Canadians. I saw a couple of bourbons and some Canadians and some Japanese whiskies as well on the shelf. How much of an interest is there at auction for whiskies from outside Scotland?
The Canadian whiskey, I don't wish to be insulting, but it's just not got a value. It's not got a market value on the other side of the pond either. Bourbons, if they're old, we recently sold some examples of pre-Prohibition era and Prohibition era bourbons very successfully. The Prohibition era ones were quite amusing as being labelled solely for medicinal purposes with stern warnings as to what would happen if it were used for other purposes. Some of the older Irish whiskies, but they do have to be rarer, things like Old Coomber. Because the Irish whiskey market has become to an extent homogenised in its production. Some of those attract fairly decent prices. And the Japanese, in retail in this country, are doing not badly. The auction side will follow in its own time. We'll see how that goes.
We see a lot of these limited edition bottlings where the limit may be 3,000 bottles or whatever, or as low as a single cask bottling of 150 or so. How much value can we expect to see those bottles appreciate in, or do we see too many of them for any of them to be really worth investing in?
I don't think there's an absolutely definitive answer to that, because many of those rare malts were bottled in runs of several thousand, and they are appreciating wonderfully at the moment. I think if you see something which says limited edition run of 11,000, you're going to have to bide your time. I'm not saying that those won't accrue value, it's just it's obvious that you're going to have to wait a fair amount of time whilst a fair few of those are drunk in order for them to appreciate to a great degree in terms of a financial return.
So let's say, for instance, a distillery-only bottling, say one of the Highland Park Ambassador's casks that were really primarily only available at the distillery. Does the rarity of where it's sold improve the value of it, such as a distillery-only bottling or one that was given to employees or, say, one of the Ardbeg Committee or Friends of Lafroig bottlings, things like that that are in much rarer quantities than a general release?
Numbers are the key here, I think. The lower the number of bottles released, I mean, it being a distillery-only release, it being only available at the distillery, will help. But a key factor in there is if that was a single cask and X number of bottles came out of it, that number of bottles is low, and that number of bottles sold through is the key element that will determine a good prospect for a long-term investment there.
I have to ask, how did you get this job? How did you come about what, for a lot of folks, would be a dream job to look at all these really classic old whiskies, but I have to also say, not be able to drink any of them?
Well, it's a bit of an odd story. I was looking to do something else that was different from the wine trade job I had, and a friend of mine who regularly buys other things from McDeal's was looking at the website, phoned me up and said, get your CV in there now, which I dutifully did and was interviewed and, as you say, was lucky enough to get one of the nicest jobs in whiskey, because I'm surprised every single day by the calls or the emails or the visits which I receive. I'm a special occasion whiskey drinker, so the idea of being surrounded by temptation isn't too devilish. But I do have my own little favourites that I secretly look at and think, yes, one of those if I'd bought it when I could afford it.
Such as?
I see Mortlach coming through now, and because of the changes of the way things are being marketed by parent companies, Mortlach is getting to be a steeper price. Longmont's too. I think Longmont's quite beautiful whiskey, but it's not so much the price, it just seems to be harder to get the 15-year-old. I'm always fond of the Lichigs, but I know that's an acquired taste for everybody, but those vary tremendously in price. It's quite interesting. But a tip to those who haven't tried it, the new Lichig 10-year-old, which is commercially available, is an absolute joy. Someone said to me, who's in the trade, and he's been in the trade longer than I have, it's the new Ardbeg 10, isn't it? And we opened the bottle here for a tasting as part of a viewing, and people were simply bowled over by it, by its sheer intensity. So I don't limit myself to one style or another. I simply look at the shelves sometimes and think, am I going to bid for that? But usually I remain quite restrained. It'd be bad for business if I started buying most of the stock.
Have you ever been surprised by something that someone has brought in that said, I've got this old bottle, can I bring it in and show it to you? And you get the Antiques Roadshow headlights in the deer in the headlights, glazed eyes look from them when you tell them this bottle is probably worth several thousand pounds.
We have had that, and it wasn't so much, I suppose, the monetary value that was attached to it, although it did have a hammer price of almost 2,000. Where a gentleman had sent me a vague email saying that he had a bottle of Patterson's, and I thought, yeah, it's probably a mirror or a jug, Patterson's. So we wrote back and I said, okay, show me. And sent me a picture, and I thought, that can't be a bottle of Patterson's. Surely can't be a bottle of Patterson's. And the gentleman came all the way from London, visited some friends in Edinburgh, and on the way, he handed me a bottle of Patterson's. And I stood with this in my hand thinking, dear God, do not drop this. This is history. Simply because of the scandal that surrounded Patterson's back in the late 19th century, there must be so very, very few of these. Because there were, in relative terms, so few bottles that they produced to begin with. Because effectively they were just running an enormous fraud scheme. And to have something like this, which has been around for so long, and which was also instrumental in almost bankrupting the Scottish whisky industry, was just quite astonishing. And I sort of looked at him and said, it's a bottle of Patterson's. And could hardly get the grin off my face. It was the same as when the gentleman said to me at the desk, I've got a Barnard book. I said, okay, show me which reproduction is it? He said, no, it's the original. Deathly silence. I said, it's the original. Good God, you really have an original. And it was just wonderful. It was like this, you know, small boy in sweet shop moment. It's absolutely wonderful. And it may not be the monetary value of some of these sites, but constantly I'm handed quite lovely things that are part of Scottish history as well as part of the history of alcohol manufacture. It's absolutely delightful.
And you also get not just bottles, but as you mentioned, the Barnard book. And I know that other artifacts have come up occasionally. What kind of artifacts would come up? Say, I know that there was a Robert Burns flask that came up a few years ago at auction, things like that that are of unique interest to collectors.
It has to be said that the vast majority of whiskey-related artifacts are not worth a huge amount of money. Now, a Barnard is different. A piece like that with an historical association is different. But they're all part of the history, and there are people out there who collect them. So it's lovely to see old mirrors and water jugs and the various paraphernalia that can come with it. We have a gentleman, I think it's in New Zealand, who's attempting to send me a very, very old customs officer's measuring cup on the stick to see the equivalent of a wine thief, to see if there's any value in that. So it'll be lovely to see what interest that raises.
Any final thoughts? Anything I haven't asked that you'd like to get across?
I think what I'd like to say is, if anyone's interested in whiskey, not to be the least bit intimidated by the phraseology, by the nomenclature, by the array of whiskey that's out there. Whiskey's a very chatty, helpful world. People love to talk about whiskey and will spend the time with you doing it. And don't be put off at the idea that you might not be able to afford whiskey as an investment or afford that one occasional special purchase just to drink. Life's too short to be inhibited like that. If you want to collect for an investment, it's a good time to do it, even if you're starting from scratch. And if you want to collect to enjoy some of the absolutely unique flavours there are, do it. Be careful with the budget, but just get involved and bid. It's exciting, it's fascinating, and there are endless resources that you can read about out there to help you with building a collection.
Once again, the next McTeers auction is set for September 28th. The final McTeers auction of the year will be on November 2nd. Tasted some very interesting whiskeys this week, and let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with one of the Adelphi single cask bottlings from the Glasgow's Whiskey Club tasting the other night. By the way, we'll hear from Adelphi's Antonia Bruce on an upcoming episode. Adelphi's Glenrothes 1990 single cask is bottled at 58.6% ABV. The nose has dried oranges and peaches, a hint of allspice, Christmas cake, and almond notes. It's very clean and smooth. The taste is clean and dry with sultana oranges, a touch of grapefruit, and a touch of dark chocolate to boot. The finish is long with a hint of orange peels and a mouth-coating dryness. I'm scoring Adelphi's Glenrothes 1990 bottling a 92. Earlier, we heard about the Lechig 2005 from Berry Brothers and Rudd that's only available in the UK at the Good Spirits Company in Glasgow. Mark and Matthew were kind enough to give me a sample to bring back for tasting. It's bottled at 61.1% ABV. The nose is smoky and phenolic with heather, charred oak, and a hint of tar. The taste starts off peaty, peppery, and mouth-filling with an unexpected caramel apple note that develops as the initial punch fades. It's a nicely complex balance of smokiness and tangy sweetness that lingers through the finish like a good barbecue sauce with a hint of smoke. I'm scoring the Berry Brothers and Rudd Lechig 2005 a 93, and I'll check for you on whether it's available outside the UK. Now, our buddy Gordon Homer of Spirit of Islay is celebrating his 50th birthday this weekend on Islay. I had lunch with Gordon and his wife, along with Serge Valentin and his wife, at Ardbeg's Old Malt Kiln Cafe on Monday during the peak of the storm that delayed our flights off the island. In fact, the power went out for a while at the cafe during lunch. Gordon brought along a special dram to celebrate his birthday. It's the first time I've ever been able to try very old Ardbeg. This 30-year-old expression was bottled in 1996 at 40% ABV. The nose is lightly smoked, soft and smooth, with hints of brine, seaweed, and a touch of allspice. The taste is smooth with pepper and smokiness that build up slowly, while never overpowering the subtle sweetness of dried fruits and honey underneath. The finish is slightly tart and clean with just a kiss of smoke. It's an amazing whiskey, and once again, thanks to Gordon for sharing it with us, and happy birthday, Gordon. Now, this week I'll be tasting the Old Forester Birthday Bourbon, the Balvenie's Tun 1401 Batch 3, and the Glenrothes 1995 before I leave for Paris. You'll find my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple version is sponsored by the Glenrothes, while the Android version is brought to you by Benromic. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find the calendar of events, links for our Facebook community page and my Twitter feed, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.